Hello and welcome to The Future Report, a podcast hosted by social research company McCrindle for anyone curious about the future. My name is Ashley Fell, and each week I'll be sitting down with a guest to discuss a topic or trend that you need to know about. Today's baby boomers are the ultimate down ages, redefining expectations of their life stage and reinventing retirement. They're buying and selling property later in life and remaining active in the workforce later than ever before. Now, this is all a response to the improved life and health realities, otherwise known as the longevity boom. So joining me today to discuss our latest research about this topic and this generation is social researcher and demographer Mark McCrindle. Mark, welcome back to the Future Report podcast.
Thanks, Ash. Great to be with you.
We're talking about baby boomers today and longevity and the future of retirement. When you talk about this generation to people, what are some of the phrases or the words or the things that you use to describe this important generation?
Well, the boomers tells the story, that label, part of this post-World War II baby boom, beginning in 1946, these unprecedented births, but really not peaking until 1961. And so they were a demographic boom. They added 50% to the population, their births. It was pretty phenomenal. And that boom of births created a boom of teenagers and redefined youth culture as we have known it ever since. They redefined the young family's life stage. They created the suburbs of our nation, and in their own boomer way had children, an echo boom of births about 20 or so years after they were born. And they were part of the economic boom in terms of property ownership and asset accumulation. And now, as they are on the edge of easing out of the workforce and thinking about retirement, they're creating a bit of a boom in retirement as well. So they have redefined every life stage and transformed Australia all the while, and have made some pretty big impacts.
Yeah, they're an amazing generation. And I feel like, I think it was the second episode of this podcast that we ever recorded. It was a Generations Defined episode, and we went through each of the generations and we talked about back then, even the okay boomer kind of quip that young people might use to talk about people who they feel are a bit redundant or a bit older. But we, in that podcast, kind of defended the boomers. We were like, no, these boomers have seen a lot of change. They've created a lot of change. They're living in their legacy years now, seeing the benefits of that for younger generations. So I do love that we get to be a little bit of generational defendants in that regard. Do you feel like that's kind of the role that we sometimes play as well?
Oh, definitely. And I guess the more you study the generations, the more you come to appreciate the impact, the contribution, you know, the attitude that each generation brings, the strengths. And the baby boomers are delivering in big quantities at the moment, because while they're a quarter of the population, they own more than half of the national private wealth of this nation. But rather than just sitting on it and enjoying their retirement, and they are enjoying their retirement, but they are passing that on. They're a generation that want to give with warm hands, not cold hands, as it were. And that is, help their children out while they still can, while they're alive, helping them with property ownership, looking at their grandkids and ensuring that they can look after that. We've done a bit of work with some of the independent schools, and it was remarkable to find that a good proportion of private school fees being paid, and not being paid by the parents, but the grandparents, these baby boomers, yet again helping out their not only their children, but their grandchildren as well. So, you know, they make incredible contributions to this nation. They're the backbone of volunteering, the backbone of the charity sector in terms of their giving. And they've got a few decades yet to keep contributing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Phenomenal. Big generation numbers and impact. We just have released this big report all about the Generations Defined, and we kind of look at them as employees and as consumers. And in that report, we also kind of take a bit of a deep dive into each generation. We've got this really cool little infographic where we talk about the places and the platforms they use to upskill themselves, the places they find community. And part of that was we explored their top hopes and fears, which we've actually done a fair bit in the past for Gen Z, but we decided to do that across all generations. And it was really interesting to see the top three hopes that the baby boomers have for their life are to have full financial freedom and independence, second, to pursue interests and hobbies, and third, to travel and see the world, which is interesting, I think. But what's fascinating when I was doing the analysis of this research was their top three fears are, number one, I won't have enough money to live comfortably. Number two, suffering a long-term illness. And number three came in the answer, none. I don't have any fears or worries. Now, every other generation, like that none option was way down the list. So I don't know if this is characteristic of their life stage or their this generation, but do you have any reflections on those top hopes and fears for the baby boomers?
Well, it does line up with some of the other findings that came through this research. You know, they do look at the future with a sense of optimism, with a sense of confidence, and it lines up with those characteristics. When we asked them, how do you describe yourself? The number one word was dependable, said 72%. You know, they began life in the post-war years with not much. They weren't given an inheritance or education to the way that we see it today. They got in and got it done and now are net contributors to the next generation, to the tax coffers of this nation. Dependable has been what they have lived through. Secondly, independent. And that's another thing about them. They're self-made in so many ways. And we sometimes call them the lucky generation in this lucky country because they've seen half a century of an economic miracle where the economy has bubbled along and where the home prices have gone up and up, and they've been the beneficiaries of that. But they created their own luck through disciplined saving and through getting in and paying down that mortgage and putting their money into appreciating assets, not just lifestyle. So independent is what they've achieved. And thirdly, resilient. 52% said that's a word they use to describe themselves. They have been through some economic shocks and cycles. And in their own personal lives, you know, untold challenges personally and through family and all of that. And yet they have shown themselves to be resilient. And that is a great example for the next generation. That is a great characteristic of how you get by. And as we look to storm clouds gathering to the future in terms of uncertainties, that's what, you know, we all need moving forward is a bit more resilience like the boomers.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn from this generation. We talked about I mentioned in the introduction to the episode that we are experiencing a longevity boom. And I kind of have to do this a lot, I guess anyone does when you're an expert or a profession in your field and you're in this a lot and you use the jargon. And I feel like we use the term longevity a lot, but I feel like maybe not everyone knows what that term means. The way that I interpret it and explain it to people is that we're living longer, we're pushing back life expectancy across the generations. Is that basically what that term means, Mark?
That's right. Yeah, living longer than ever. And that's true at an individual level, you know, that we've got a generation now living longer than the one that went before. But it's true at a national sense where we see that median age, that midpoint in our population moving up. It was in the mid-30s just a few decades ago. It's late 30s now, at 38 currently. Life expectancy at birth now exceeds 85 years of age. And that means most people will have at least two decades post-retirement in which to live. And that life expectancy, if we look at the latest research on that, in 40 years, it'll be pushing into 90 years of age. So not all of those longevity gains have yet been achieved. So certainly we have an aging population from that good news story of life expectancy increasing, longevity, but it does come at a cost. We've got more retirees now than ever before. 4.1 million people have retired from the workforce in Australia. And keep in mind that we've only got 4 million school students. So we've got more retirees than school students. Gives you a bit of a sense as to the shape of our population profile, more people at the upper edge than the older edge. It used to be called a population pyramid. It's definitely become far more rectangular now. And those 4.1 retirees are added to by 150,000 extra retirees every year. So that's what we currently have in Australia. And those numbers, yeah, continue to increase.
Yeah, it's fascinating. That's a really stark way of putting it. I feel like more retirees than students is quite telling of where our population is tipping towards. And I'm pretty sure that's quite common among other developed nations as well, that aging population. So a big issue to be thinking about and the impact on our communities and our taxpayers and the elderly themselves and how we care for them. And I remember our aged care supply and demand workforce infographic we did a few years ago, even around the workforce that's going to be required to supplement that more and more retirees. So some big implications there, of course. And again, you've done a fair bit more research into this, Mark, than I have around the government's most recent intergenerational report. Did that reveal a lot about retirement and the aging population in that particular report?
Yeah, it did. And it's a fascinating report. It's scheduled to come out every 5 years, and it's been coming out now for 20 years. But the next one wasn't due for a few more years, but they brought out an update after just 2 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's because the changes have been so significant, and they just wanted to highlight this, you know, that we've got this population that's growing significantly. And the purpose of the intergenerational report is to forecast forward over the next four decades. So it's showing that our population will be larger than ever. We're adding 14.5 million people over the next four decades. So that's a nearly 60% increase in our population. So we'll be larger. But as we've just discussed, we will be older. Between now and then, four decades, the over 65 population will double. The over 85 population will triple. And that median age we discussed, that's 38 at the moment, will hit 43, the midpoint in our population. So a bigger population and older population with that slower GDP or economic growth. It's been averaging about 3% per annum. It's over the next four decades going to average about 2% per annum. So quite a slide there, but that comes about just because of some of these demographic challenges that we're dealing with, and you know, more people moving out of the workforce than relative to the total population. Higher costs are forecast, obviously aged care costs, healthcare costs, but NDIS, the disability scheme that we have in Australia, set to rise and take a bigger share of the Commonwealth costs each year. And talking about the growth opportunities, the supply and demand equation around aged care and healthcare, there are currently 2.5 million people in the care workforce. The forecasts are in four decades, we'll need 4.5 million. So nearly doubling that number, pretty impactful. And what's remarkable amidst all of this is that while we're living longer, the age of retirement hasn't really changed much. We're still retiring on average around 65 for women, slightly younger than that, 64 and a bit for men, slightly above the 65 and a half. And even though we're living longer, that retirement age seems to be a bit stuck there. In fact, the data looks at asking people when you plan on retiring and when you're actually retiring, and people plan on retiring about 2 years later than they actually do. In other words, while they have a goal, they tap out early. They say, you know, I said 66, 67, I'm actually done, I'm leaving. So even with the forecasts, we tend to be retiring a bit earlier, and 40% of people go from retirement onto the age pension. So this, therefore, creates a bit of an economic challenge. That's what the Intergenerational Report is trying to highlight. It's put out by Treasury, released by the Treasurer, showing that we've got some structural challenges here. As the population continues to age, as the health and aged care costs continue to rise, with more people retiring than ever, almost half of them, 40% at least, going straight onto a pension, and yet fewer people paying tax as earners to fund this aging curve we're on, we perhaps need to look at how this is working and think of other ways of both managing costs and also increasing revenue. So that's really what the Intergenerational Report is about, and it certainly raises a few flags.
Yeah, it paints some pretty big challenges for us in the years to come. It's interesting that they've released it 3 years ahead of maybe when they were projected to, if they're doing it every 5 years. Is that because of the pandemic, do you think?
Yeah, partly the pandemic, partly that it's a new government in town and they wanted to put their own stamp on it. The previous one released by Josh Frydenberg. And so I guess, you know, the Labor government giving their own particular perspective, partly because some of the forecasts actually improved because the revenues, we had a surplus with the federal budget, which was expected to have, you know, rolling deficits. So that meant that some of the 40-year forecast could actually be improved. So the budget bottom line is not quite as bad as it would have otherwise been. Commodity prices doing well, exports doing well. So that's been a bit of a buffer, better than what we had planned. But the basic structure of the report, the 3P structure, still highlights the same challenges. The first P of population, you know, if we look at our economic growth, it's fed a little bit by population. And while there's growth there, that growth is going to slow a little bit 14.5 million people. That's a lot of new people. It comes at a cost of infrastructure and planning, but the growth rate is slowing slightly, largely through declining births. The second P that might help the economy is participation. And amazingly, the forecasts are for participation in the labor force to drop. And we talked about the increased retirees, people not wanting to work longer, but even average hours worked across the workforce is dropping. People are chasing a bit of lifestyle. And we've seen that even increase since the pandemic. So participation is not going to save us. We can't take the people we've got and work more hours to get greater output, which leaves the third P of productivity. Maybe we can take, therefore, the people we've got and the hours they're prepared to work and get greater return per person per hour, productivity, as maybe the savior in the economic equation. But even that is a bit uncertain, and they're not expecting a big turnaround there. Maybe what will help the economy in the future is AI, is technology bringing about a productivity boost that we haven't yet seen. But you know, we're a services economy, particularly relying on a workforce to meet care needs, to meet education needs, health needs, and that's hard to outsource to AI. So a few challenges there around those three Ps, but you know, it's all to win in terms of productivity if we can find efficiencies, as in Australia we tend to do, innovations that might turn the economy around and lead to some better outcomes that otherwise would be forecast.
Yeah, it's great that it gives us hopefully a bit of a suggestion or a roadmap to get our way through that seemingly pretty big challenge with so many people aging and, a lot of older people to care for in the future. Another release or data release that I know that you've been delivering a fair bit of commentary on, Mark, which kind of is in relation to this, is a release from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, again, about retirement. And I saw this article that you were cited in, and it says Australians are retiring later in life, which we've kind of mentioned a little bit there. And Queensland is the top destination for those seeking a new adventure in their golden years, according to data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And it went on to say, well, I think it's now directly quoting you, since COVID, we've seen a rebalancing of our population away from the southern states and the capital cities that were dominant, like Sydney and Melbourne, and to the regional areas, particularly to Queensland. Is that the message of that kind of release? Is that kind of the headline that you feel like it's proposing in terms of people retiring, but also where they're heading?
Yeah, exactly. It's remarkable to think that, for example, New South Wales population is 60% larger than Queensland. In fact, Sydney has more people than the whole state of Queensland. And yet Queensland's growth in the last 12 months has been 70% larger than that of New South Wales. So its growth is phenomenal. You can't overstate the impact of growth in Queensland now, and it's particularly internal migration. It's Victorians and people from New South Wales heading up north, and that's true across the age groups, but even more the case for retirees. It's the place to head. It long has been that sea change retirement destination, but that's accelerated since COVID. And Queensland has seen an increase in the over 65 population just in 10 years. They had, well, if we just take the Gold Coast as an example, that's been the crossroads of retirement hotspot for Queensland. They had 74,000 people over 65. If we go back 10 years ago, today there's 120,000 people aged over 65 just in that one city of Gold Coast. So you can see that big increase in the number of retirees there. And they're choosing that clearly because of the climate and the lifestyle up there. It's a big coastline and lots of spots to retire, lots of provisions for retirees with aged care and particularly retirement living and retirement-friendly communities. But beyond that, it's the affordability that Queensland offers even over, say, Sydney and Melbourne. And so if you can get better affordability and increase the lifestyle, then certainly it's a place to go. So Queensland has been drawing in the numbers. And it's not just Southeast Queensland. The thing is, you know, with our demographic analysis, Ashley, is that more than half of Queensland's population lives outside of Brisbane. And so it's a very decentralized population. New South Wales, two-thirds of New South Wales lives in Sydney and three-quarters of Victoria lives in Melbourne. So the southern states are very centralized around the capital. Queensland has, I think, 11 now of our top 30 cities, more of our top 30 cities than any other state, all up and down the coast, and they all provide opportunities for retirees to have both that lifestyle, that livability, but also with the options there, some good affordability as well. So that's attracting retirees to the Sunshine State, and it seems as if that trend is set to continue.
Yeah, it's been an amazing story for Queensland over the last few years. I feel like that's been the one we often talk about, and we see Sydney and Melbourne, or rather New South Wales and Victoria, in some of the different areas of population growth in the red. They're losing people often to Queensland, and Queensland's got that, as I've heard us say, that triple green light around net interstate migration, net overseas, and natural increase. So it's an incredible story and incredible outlook as we look to the future with the Olympic Games set to be there in about a decade's time. So yeah, it's fascinating for people living there. And I guess even one of the questions a few people are asking, and even where we get some of these insights and data, is to go, well, can the infrastructure support that kind of population growth, and what needs to be done early so that there aren't those some of those pain points like some of the other states and territories in Australia have experienced, I guess, is part of that. So fascinating stuff. And I guess part of this, Mark, and some of these releases and our research around longevity and the baby boomer generation particularly, is to think about the future of retirement and what it could look like. I guess if people are living longer, they do have more years of life to sustain financially. So there's that element. But there's also, I imagine, an element of what people do with their time and how they spend those retirement years. It's fascinating when we think, I guess, about retirement from the sheer fact that we often think it's retiring from work. But I know that you've got some insights even around different industries and how they permit us to retire, you know, whether it's manual labor versus knowledge economy or even the role of work in retirement. Do you have any insights to share with our listeners about what the future of retirement is going to look like for this generation?
Yeah, when we're just starting to see some of these trends come to pass, what the future of retirement will look like. Firstly, we will retire later. Now, in the last 12 months, just one in 10 retirees was age 70 or older, which, you know, again, based on that life expectancy, you'd expect more to work later, but we're still retiring at that traditional age. It's crept up a little bit, but that will accelerate over the years ahead. So we will see far more people work not just to 70, but through their 70s, because they will be able to. But we're seeing changes to retirement as well. People are leaving an industry, leaving a job, but not leaving work. That is that they're shifting from maybe leaving as an employee. And the number one reason for people retiring in this latest data is not because of mobility or illness or sickness. It's not because their work finished, or they were restructured out, or were dismissed. It's because they hit retirement age. They hit an eligibility qualification, and they were able to get, therefore, some financial benefits. So, in other words, they're leaving because they sort of are released. They've hit that target. They've done that time, but they're not ready to stop work. And so, we're seeing people leave employment, but then continue in other work, and that might be gig economy or contracting or part-time employment. It might be their own business. It might be turning a hobby into an earner. And that's, I think, important for the future. And we'll see much more of that. We're seeing people become increasingly self-funded. Now, I mentioned that 40% are retiring and moving to the pension, but not every one of those to the full pension. Some people just have a part pension because they've got other assets. And over the generation ahead, as we look to the Gen Xer and Gen Y after them, we'll have the majority of people self-funded. And so that'll mean that they will not only therefore be able to continue work, there's going to be no financial penalty if they keep earning because they're not relying on government payments anyway, but they'll have some leverage, some money, some options to enjoy that retirement lifestyle in the way they want. So we'll see a lot more people travel. Now, that's always been a big thing, but overseas travel. They won't sell off the car, they'll upgrade the car. They might downsize the home in terms of the empty nest home, but they'll upscale in terms of the lifestyle, and they'll remain active in property a lot later. They'll give and contribute, but also spend money as economic contributors. So the whole reality of retirement is starting to change because the equation of longer years of life and longer activity across those years will enable them to do so. And work, as we wrote much about in our book, Ash, on work wellbeing, work is not the same as employment. It's not the same as a job. Work is, well, volunteering or looking after grandkids or making a contribution, part-time contributions as well in employment. It's all manner of things, and it doesn't require payment for a lot of that work, but it's still productive, contributing, and personally benefiting work. It's the place where people get a social connection. Work, whether it be volunteer or paid, is a place where people can grow their skills and can stretch and be stimulated. And it's the place where, you know, it's a regular connection with others, and that's healthy and important for us socially as well. So I expect to see some of these trends continue to play out, and work will be redefined just as retirement will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I can quote you back to you, which I've already done once in this episode, but I'm doing it again because we talked about this off mic earlier today, and as we were prepping for this episode, and I was noting down a few things that you said, and you always throw out some really good phrases. And one you were talking about, people retiring from an industry but not from the workforce. They might quit their job but not stop their earnings. And you said the future of retirement is a slow exit, not a farewell party, which I thought was quite profound and quite a good summary of some of the trends that we're seeing here for the baby boomers, but even like you said, for the generations to come after them in retirement, as we think of some of these kind of longer term trends rather than kind of the snap ones like technology. Mm. We're talking about demographics here, which is more of that kind of tide metaphor that we talk about, that increases over time rather than kind of just shocks us into being immediately. So fascinating insights.
I think that's a great thing. You know, we used to think of retirement as someone getting the golden watch, you know, the farewell party and all of that. But the great thing that will enable people to work a lot later is if they downshift. And these days, employers, the workplace flexibility will allow that. You know, it doesn't have to be 5 days. It doesn't always have to be in the office. It could be 4, 3, 2. Could be coming in as a consultant in a new structured way, or could be leaving that particular employment and picking up work in other forms. So I think it's that flexibility that means that retirement will be this downshift and will allow the benefits of work and even some of the earnings without that cold hard conclusion to employment. And that's got to be healthy for the individual and beneficial to the economy overall, particularly as we face these shortages in workforce, as we've discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating insights as always, Mark. Thanks very much for breaking down some of this latest research that we've conducted, some from the government, from the ABS, from the Treasurer. So really fascinating insights about this topic. So thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Ash.
And if people would like to kind of dig into the research that we have talked about today, a lot of that has come from our Generations Defined report, which we've just released, where we kind of expose each generation and explore and dig into some of the trends around consumers and around employees. So if you'd like to uncover that, you can just head to our website, macrindle.com. Of course, if you'd like to stay up to date with our latest insights in general, you can always subscribe to the podcast. You can follow us on social media or explore our website and our articles at macrindle.com. So as always, thank you again for listening, and bye for now.